to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
And we are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III, hiding out in Palm Springs.
Ooh, glamour. I'm Louis Fertel, and can I hear a little bit of a mild dust storm in your voice? Did you maybe inhale some desert air? I'm getting the movie Tremors from what I'm hearing in your voice.
Not Tremors.
Reba's best acting moment. Take that, Annie. Get your gun.
I was at Coachella this past weekend, as I'm wont to do every year. And also, I am recovering from the Coachella flu, as it were. I'm not really sick, but there is a certain congestion that happens when you are in the desert for multiple days on end, inhaling dust.
Mother of God. No, I was very jealous watching all the clips over the weekend. As I said, I knew Doja Cat would do something frightening. And one, it was the fur bikini. And then two, it was the Cousin It outfit, which she got me to my feet. And I was just sitting in my own home. So good for her.
Yeah, we're going to talk about my Coachella experience this episode. But wow, Doja was truly like the last thing I saw
before you blacked out for good.
Yes. Headline Sunday night. And I saw the Scarlet Tour recently and just how she, you know, visually did something completely different for the Coachella show was sort of amazing. It's actually been really amazing, her in particular, her trajectory over the past year. She had her sort of enfant terrible moment where she was, didn't give a fuck about the industry, didn't give a fuck about her fans. All of the responses to her making a song called Demons and being demonic and people not liking that. And then now being praised as one of the, you know, the best headliners since Beyonce did Beachella. It's just the swing that she's done has been fantastic to see. And it's really just because she seems, however she acts when she's fed up with people or fed up with the industry, she's always devoted to just like giving you the best shit she can give you.
I also just forget when I look at the Coachella lineup and seeing all the names there, I just assume, oh, it's like a bunch of these artists just run to the festival and put on a show. But no, what you're actually getting at Coachella almost every time is a very bespoke experience from that artist. You know, like I really should take the cue of Beachella here, where you go there and it's, you're going to be watching something you're not going to see anywhere else. You know, like someone like, I don't know, Carly Rae Jepsen, for example, I kind of see her a lot. And so I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to go to Coachella and it's going to be another version of that. But no, the demand when once you're there is to bring something hyper large and, you know, super throbbing as opposed to just, you know, WeHo Pride or something. Not to disparage my beloved WeHo Pride. And Tinashe, who I believe is still trapped there. Yes.
Tinashe did a fantastic set at Coachella, by the way.
Imagine if she didn't. That's all she does. Yeah.
It was her first Coachella. And I would say that, yes, the people who sort of lose at Coachella are the people who are already on tour And it's just sort of a, they treat it as a tour stop. And it is, we're just going to do the exact same show that people are already getting in any other city.
Yeah.
For a lot of other people, it's either their first Coachella or they really want to make it sort of pop. Because it's also being live streamed.
Right.
It's being live streamed and everyone can watch it. So it behooves you to do something a little bit different for Coachella and also to use it as a calling card, sort of an advertisement for your tour.
Got it. Got it. Well, we will get into that as well as, I can't believe this is sort of the take we're going with this week, but O.J. Simpson died. And so to celebrate, in air quotes, in asterisks, we're going to talk about our favorite tabloid manias just of all time. Pick a couple of ones that have stuck in our craw that we've enjoyed, that we continue to digest. Doing a lot of bird chewing metaphors today. I can't explain that.
That is an interesting take, that O.J. Simpson died, because I don't know if I believe it.
Yeah.
The juice is still loose.
Yeah, right. The story doesn't fit. You must acquit. I don't have the joke yet. I'm sorry. That was a glimpse inside my creative process.
Well, we also get a glimpse inside another artist's fantastic creative process today, because we talked to Nick Offerman.
I have to say, look, we've had a lot of wonderful, like Carla Gugino just recently was fabulous to talk to. The streak continues. Sitting with this man, you just want to hold on to the table and listen to the the woodworker quality that is his voice. It just feels like somebody who is a carpenter, which is what he is. He's so thoughtful and so fabulous, and we could have done the whole episode just talking to him about anything, and not even just his own credits. He could be talking about any old play and would be interested and interesting.
No, I feel like the only disappointing thing about the interview is, you know, he is listing off all these sort of plays coming from Chicago theater himself, like The Kentucky Cycle by like Robert Shanken. And it's like, I can't even, there's no time to dive into all of that. It's just like every random theater reference that he makes, I'm like, I know that playwright, I know that thing. Let's talk about it for several hours. So we have to get him back at some point. But this is a fantastic interview with Nick Offerman, with a lot of metaphors.
Oh, yeah. As he will note himself, you'll enjoy it.
Yeah. I think he birthed maybe at least three memoir titles in this
Right. In this interview. He should be mining this episode for future sales. Yes.
So we will be right back with more Keep It. It's 2024. We're facing another election with unprecedented stakes. That's right. Unprecedented stakes. Not chicken. Not salmon. Stakes.
If you're not sure how to make an impact, Vote Save America's Anxiety Relief Program will route your recurring donations directly to grassroots organizations and down-ballot candidates who need it most at that exact moment. With your help, they raised over $210,000 of recurring donations from over 4,700 donors just in March alone. Your donations help to support the work of the Black Male Initiative, Freedom Block Ohio, and Detroit Action, who are working to increase voter turnout and political power among Black communities, plus other organizations mobilizing for voter registration this year.
Let's keep this momentum going this election year. Head to VoteSaveAmerica.com to set up a recurring donation today. Paid for by Vote Save America, VoteSaveAmerica.com, not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. We've officially closed the books on Coachella Weekend 1 and possibly the careers of everyone on Grimes' team.
Oh, God. Wait, what happened?
So, for those who didn't see the headlines or weren't there seeing Grimes do her DJ set, it was giving Frank Ocean level mess.
Really?
Only this one was unintentional. In a sense, Frank, I would still classify as worse than Grimes, because the sort of I don't care to be here attitude was a little bit more annoying last year. And the coming on late was also aggravating, particularly because if your set is 30 minutes after it was supposed to start, then it is going to be much shorter than anticipated.
Yes.
Especially with a Sunday night headline and we're all standing there waiting for this festival to be over.
And all his team is sitting there like using a hose to water down an ice rink or whatever happened that year. It was so zany.
The ice rink he didn't want to use anymore. Yeah.
Right. I know the feeling.
Grimes is DJing and basically she's trying to track the BPM of the music in her head instead of using headphones, I believe. And there are just many instances where the music is stopping and there are other technical difficulties. And it became a problem mostly because she kept communicating to the audience that there were technical difficulties and apologizing and tried to explain what was happening. And listen, this is a crowd of people on drugs, yeah. dancing the music, and all of a sudden now you are trying to explain things to them.
Well, let me just say, I feel like a lot of the time when I go to like a warehouse party or something where there's like extremely throbbing, loud music, you know, there's a vibe in that atmosphere. And it feels to me like about half the time, somebody will get on a mic, cut the mic, and just start talking about something for a second. And I'm like, I feel like this is a dystopian moment. Like, I am utterly lizard-brained right now. And you are asking me to process words as if I am in an airport and I'm at the wrong gate.
I always feel like it is better to just let us sit in silence for a brief moment. And not say anything.
Yeah.
Because we'll just think it's part of the show.
And right. And then no matter what music comes next, I'm so excited to hear it because it's not silence.
Yes. I mean, speaking of music that she did play, the visuals, first of all, for Grimes are fucking fantastic. And there was a moment where there's this sort of robotic spider walking around the stage by her.
It's giving John Peters ideas for Wild Wild West. Yes.
But she played in her set the Ting Tings, That's Not My Name, and I did not realize how much that song is crack cocaine.
Oh, if the term pop off wasn't invented because of that song, it's about exactly that time period, you know, around the time of shows like Bad Girls Club. Applies exactly to that song. Yeah, that I'm trying. It's like the best possible version of both a Paramore song and an Avril Lavigne song.
Yeah, it comes on, and I tell you, we were standing in the crowd. We were rushed by just sort of younger millennial, elder Gen Z girls. Who just sort of like had to get closer. You know that feeling when you're in a crowd and, you know, a sort of song comes on from an artist and then just people who are in the back are so energized that they're running forward. And it was a stampede. I felt like Simba.
That was cut out of the movie when him being a Ting Ting stan. Yeah.
But yeah, so I could go, you know, from the beginning of arriving at Coachella.
Yeah. And, oh, a travelogue experience. This is very inviting. You're like Joni Mitchell.
Yeah. Well, so first of all, there's a pre-party at Coachella, which is maybe one of my favorite performances that I saw in a funny way. It was good, but it sort of exemplifies who this artist is. The Thursday that we arrived there, there was a party by Paper Magazine and Sweetie performed.
Oh, radio hits to the nth. We enjoy.
Yeah. It was beautiful watching Sweetie arrive to the party. I have video of her arriving with her security team. Within 1 minute, she was on the stage, purse still on.
Aretha. It's giving Aretha.
She did her 20-minute set, and then she was, bye, y'all. And left.
Wow. Like downright antisocial. Do we think the cash money was in the purse as Aretha preferred?
Absolutely. They handed it to her before she walked on stage. And she was like, this is how I do it.
Petty theft. Yeah.
And then Friday, of course, let me say something about this Coachella. I feel like you're talking about the lineup before. The headliners were Tyler, the Creator. They were Doja Cat. They were Lana Del Rey, and then, of course, No Doubt as a special headliner guest. And, you know, every year there's not sort of a Beyonce, there's not a Billie Eilish. People sort of, you know, critique the lineup, and there's this thing that, you know, you need these big stars. There's this sort of idea that if you don't have these bigger headliners, that the overall festival is going to lack, you know? But I feel like when there are so many different artists that you really enjoy just all playing for 3 days, you're going to have an amazing experience. And I felt like this ended up being one of my favorite Coachellas because it wasn't centered around, I'm focused on only seeing like Beyonce today.
Yeah, right. No, because if it's like a gladiatorial event, like I'm here to see this one thing when I go to Coachella most of the time. And so when it's just like everybody feels sort of like they get their own space and you get to respect them for it and you're not looking at your watch being like, but I've got to get to Beyonce, I'm sure that's kind of a relief.
Yeah. And also ask me about anything else that happened the year Beyonce performed.
Precisely. Yeah.
I don't recall.
Right.
So Friday opened up with, I do want to call out White Claw for scamming me, because we were invited to this special sort of event with Charli XCX. And I'm thinking, this is going to be a DJ set. This is going to be, maybe she's performing one of her new songs. We arrive into this White Claw activation, as it were. Everyone likes to call things activations. And Charli sort of walks in, and then we're all corralled into a meet and greet photo op with her.
Okay.
Not a performance whatsoever, which is fine. You know, in theory, you know, you get a photo with an artist that you love, you get to chat with her for a bit, but I was expecting something else. And I was like, I don't even know if I want a fucking photo right now.
Right. Also, something about like, I'm being corralled into a photo with celebrity is just not extremely lovely vibes. I don't need pictures with celebrities personally. But I will say, I do think maybe nobody has consumed more White Claws in history than the fans of Charli XCX. So I do want to congratulate the ad marketing team for putting that together.
One of the first people that I saw on Friday is, of course, continuing this journey of listening, learning, discovering new things about myself. It was Chappell Roan. And girl, I love this bitch.
We're signing on to her. I was initially questioning the physical aesthetic, you know, the Raggedy Andy look, the Raggedy Ann look. But the voice is fabulous. And she really is somebody who's focused on a gigantic pop hook, which is sort of not really, I like it when it comes from Ava Max, and there are a couple people who like just hit you with a big hook. But she's also bringing a sardonic edge, which is very welcome.
Yeah, it's a Lady Gaga-esque in a bit, in the sense that there's the pop hooks, there's the sort of theatricality that's going on here. But man, she was a great fucking performer.
Yeah.
And it was a great show. The Chappell Roan fans, I'm still on the fence about.
Well, I have to
say, they're a little weird.
I always bring up my brother Jim one time, I think he tweeted it. He said, all fan bases suck. And I do want to say, when anybody stands one thing, you know, that means they're missing out on a large portion of the world and maybe some essential nutrients just in their life. I question fan bases, generally speaking, but I kind of like the people who are gathering behind Chappell Roan. I think everybody is sort of surprised they love it so much. You know, like, how has this person been around so many years and I haven't signed on already?
I'm surprised that there are so many straight people doing poppers at her show.
See, concerning. That's your culture isn't my costume or whatever it is, like that whole thing. Just be concerned with that. Me and my friends deserve to have scabs around our nostrils. Okay. Not you.
Now, I don't know what you think about Tiny Princess Sabrina Carpenter, but she was also great. And I'm obsessed with her new song, Espresso.
I haven't heard it yet.
It's giving pop masterpiece. It's giving pop summer bop.
Finally. I you know what I always think about in regards to summer music or song of the summer? I think it's something that really became important to people because of Teenage Dream and the song California Girls, which you feel like a beach ball is being tossed around. Like, we miss the literal summeriness of that. We have had so few of those since that time. Like, there are so few definitive songs of the summer. So when you say that, that gets me excited to rekindle 2010 and the Kesha-fication of the world, which I think is dwindling, even though I loved what I saw of her at Coachella.
With Renee Rapp. Yeah, she appeared.
What a great pair.
You sort of wouldn't expect it, but once you see it, it's perfect. And Renee Rapp just sort of has this quality. She had a big black sort of overcoat. She had her black bra on, giving some lesbian rocker down.
Yes.
And she had no other set, really, besides just her microphone. And it was just, everyone had so much fun at that concert. And Kesha, of course, changed her lyric, wake up in the morning feeling like P. Diddy, to feeling like fuck P. Diddy. So
yes.
That was fun.
Also jokes. Yes, funny.
Yeah.
Also, Renee Rapp in general, the way she dresses, she really, you kind of just nailed that, like that Crystal Waters-y mid-90s fit. Mm, she does it maybe better than everybody. And it really fits the queerness, too. It just, it says something about her. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I want to say that there's this also idea that this was going to be sort of a lesser Coachella, but all of the celebrities were fucking there. You had Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce just hanging out in the artist section, watching Dom Dalla, watching Ice Spice, having Ice Spice basically be the third wheel on their date
right.
in most of the videos that you see them in.
I was shocked to see Taylor Swift, I don't know why, in like a baseball cap and windbreaker, like she was playing the lead character in Drive, walking away from a getaway.
It is sort of weird to imagine her being there, but also she was just recently spotted at Barty's Beanery, of all places, in West Hollywood. And you always forget that when she has an album coming out, that woman is everywhere.
Right. And even the smallest appearance like has this butterfly effect where everybody in the world hears about it. Yes, Barney's Beanery is right near where I work out, and it is run by alums of the University of Iowa, so they play all the basketball games and stuff there. So if I want French onion soup and straight people to play the game of billiards next to me, that is where I go.
My other favorite highlights were obviously, for me, no doubt, was the pinnacle of the weekend. And I have heard some mixed things online from people, but everyone that I was with and everyone who has sort of experienced No Doubt before and experienced Gwen Stefani prior to solo Gwen Stefani had a fucking blast. And it was so much fun seeing her take on that character again.
Yes. You know what? I always think about one time when she made an appearance on the Jimmy Fallon Tonight Show. It was right when he was doing the beginning of the lip syncs he would do that would become the show lip sync battle. But she appeared and I forget what she was lip syncing. As a live performer, what she was doing, the like kind of like the swimmy dance moves and the like kind of light thrusting she does, she is so captivating to watch live. You don't think of No Doubt. I mean, even though No Doubt has ska beginnings and they're a fabulous band, I don't think of them as like a definitive live act. And I think she is probably best experienced live.
Yeah. And I will say that for a lot of people who has just sort of not experienced this version of Gwen ever, or haven't seen it in decades, just seeing her in this sort of like ska personality, just sort of rocking around the stage, you know, singing raspy, shouting out random things while she's performing. Like that was sort of like vintage No Doubt in what it was. And we sort of lost, I would say, that quality of female performer in a band. Like that just genre of music, that sort of attitude that exists on stage doesn't really happen anymore. It's sort of in a time capsule.
Yeah, right.
Front women of bands, they just sort of there's a different way to act like a rock artist now. And you're not acting like a girl from Orange County in the late 80s, early 90s, making ska music with like Sublime and everything else.
It
you
seems
know?
Like what you're saying is the quality of bodaciousness is lacking in the world today. Bodacious is exactly what she was. That was the whole thing she brought to No Doubt. But I saw a clip of her performing Bathwater at Coachella.
With Olivia Rodrigo.
Yes, definitely a song that should be experienced live. I mean, I like this the studio recording of it off that really good album, Return of Saturn. But there, her screaming it alongside Olivia Rodrigo, it became so anthemic.
Yeah, and Olivia Rodrigo actually feels a lot like the perfect person to take on that No Doubt mantle. Like, she seems like a rocker who has studied at you know, the altar of people like Gwen Stefani.
Oh, yeah. The music is designed to, I think, seem like a successor to all of that music, too.
Yes. I will say that obviously for a lot of people, this was Lana Chella. And you know what? I enjoy Lana Del Rey. I'm wearing a Lana shirt right now from Coachella. But there's something about Lana Del Rey where if you are obsessed with her, you were sobbing. You were having a spiritual experience. It was like you were in a cult. If you are interested in many of her songs and have not fully listened to all of her albums because, you know, they are sort of chillaxed, your high at home music.
And I'll say a lightly dreary. There's a dreariness to Lana Del Rey.
Watching a concert that long from her was a bit of a chore.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were parts where I was interested in. There were parts where there was a big lull. I was really into it when Billie Eilish showed up and they sang Ocean Eyes together.
Amazing, amazing performance. And like just, it doesn't spring to top of mind that they would be a perfect fit for each other. But like they definitely do that I'm a whispering character in the dark thing. Why wouldn't we pair them together?
Mm-hmm. And then obviously other bigger highlights were Flo. Amazing girl group out of the UK. They're really sort of coming up now with music being produced by M&EK for them, and their sort of Destiny's Child throwback vibe. So they were a highlight. Victoria Monet was fucking amazing.
I loved what I saw of Victoria Monet. And also just continue to love her renaissance. There's just such a quality of the music there that is rare for someone who's getting that popular. Like somebody where it's like a particular Grammy win I will always remember. You know, best new artist is not always a triumph.
People who were shockingly great to me, not shockingly, but, you know, I hadn't really expected them to be sort of slaying, serving cunt, as it were. Mm-hmm. Ice Spice and Bebe Rexha.
I thought Bebe Rexha sounded fabulous. And Ice Spice, I'm a fan. The personality, I'm a huge fan. The music, I like.
Yeah, a lot of the songs sound the same to me, but she had a bust down on, you know, the wig, the hair was flowing, the set was fun. She kept you entertained, and that's really sort of all that you really need from these people. And lastly, I will say that I obviously go to a lot of DJ sets, and, you know, a lot of it is queer heavy. You know, there's Honey Dijon.
Yes.
And who played, and, you know, she did her honey thing. On this new stage called Kazar, which is sort of like where she played there, JBXX played there. It's sort of a very long stage that does it, that's, you know, it's horizontal in scope and not really vertical. So I don't love it as a stage because it sort of invites you to pass by it, give a glance, and then just sort of leave. It feels like it's a stop on the way somewhere else. Like, it doesn't really feel like a full stage. So we didn't spend a lot of time there.
It doesn't have anything to do with Kazar from Big Brother, does it?
No, absolutely not, unfortunately.
Okay, well, now I'm definitely not going to participate. All right.
But a lot of the DJs that I got into this weekend were people I can only describe as straggots.
There's a lot more of them than ever.
There are. There is this new era of straight DJ who is just sort of so queer adjacent in either their style of dress. There's Clooney. And I'm not talking about pulling up in the Danny Ocean.
Yeah.
I'm talking, it's spelled C-L-O-O-N-E-E. Him painting his nails black. Very Carson Daly. Very Ira Madison III.
Yeah.
There's Dom Dalla. There's John Summit. These people have gay fan bases. And when they play music, like all three of them played at this after party called Framework. Which were all of the gays appeared at, is sort of, you know what it's like at a horse meat disco. But imagine all of the gays in the center of the dance floor doing all of that behavior, surrounded by straight people. They were sort of segregated to the center.
They're the eye of the tornado. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. We don't want to see that shit. All of you be in the center here. Just all these shirtless gays making out with each other. These DJs played this after party Framework, and John Summit is giving you like gay circuit party music.
I mean, gay circuit party music, I can hear any party I go to. But the idea that like straight people are producing it, was it Diplo who did like a, he did some sort of gay party and then pictures afterwards came out?
Pegasus in LA.
And excuse me, he took a picture of the audience. Girl, we need you to sign an NDA next time. I was looking in the pupils of that picture. It was giving raccoons needing a hit of something. I don't know. It was very shocking. And I also recognized half the people. It looked like a picture you would see in like the police blotter in the 70s. Like, look at all these queens out at night.
I want to say lastly about these, the Straggit DJs appearing in the music scene. We're going to see a lot more. Obviously, photos of the dance floor, et cetera, because he's taking one and there's going to be new audiences of people there. Let's do less of that. You're right. You're recognizing people. Even if you're just taking a video yourself at the party, tilt it up to the DJ and not the crowd. Because I'm looking through people's Instagram stories and I'm like, okay, well, now I see what Gus Kentworthy was doing at 3 a.m.
That's what I mean, right. No, I don't need to know exactly how much you're sweating at 3:45, right.
If you're going to party with the queens, you're going to have to sign a non-disclosure.
Yeah, please, please.
Anyway, Coachella was great.
Yes.
I'm going to go back, obviously.
And your voice seems to have come back since you've started talking, so I think you've been truly energized by the festival, ultimately.
Well, thank you, Red Bull, who also paid for my ticket.
Sugar-free or not?
Sugar-free.
Okay, good. I call a sugar-free Red Bull Carly Rae Jepsen, because who better lives the feel of a sugary Red Bull than Carly Rae Jepsen?
Although a lot of gays are drinking regular Red Bull with vodka now, because I get the same thing that some people say when they drink Coca-Cola. As opposed to Diet Coke, they're like, if I'm going to drink it, I want the real taste.
Mm, I call this halo top syndrome. We just want the real ice cream. Yeah.
All right. When we are back, we are joined by the fantastic Nick Offerman to talk about his exciting new movie, Civil War. This week's guest has become one of our most beloved faces and voices, from his leading roles in Parks and Recreation and Devs to an unforgettable Emmy-winning performance in The Last of Us to being one half of comedy's funniest couple. He's now leading a war-torn America in his latest project, Civil War. Please welcome to Keep It, Nick Offerman.
Thank you.
Hello.
It was nice watching you kind of ponder your credits there. He put his rested his hand in his shoes. Like, I guess I was in those. Come to think of it,
I was picturing them in a thought bubble.
They'll all be in your Kennedy Center honors someday. So just make sure you get them all straight chronologically in your head.
I really appreciate your optimism.
I want to ask you about this film, which is. Incredible. I'm such a fan of Alex Garland. And it's this dystopian view of America. The Civil War has broken out. There's obviously a lot going on within the script to just sort of figure out as a viewer of it. I would love to know, when you first got this, just sort of what questions you had for Alex and whether or not he answered any of them, or they were just for you to figure out?
Well, thank you, first and foremost, for your generous introduction. I concur. I'm a huge fan of Alex for many years. And so I was absolutely flabbergasted when he turned his gaze my way to be in his show Devs. And we became great friends, and Megan makes fun of me because I'm openly besotted with him. I just get huge googly heart eyes whenever I'm around Alex. And so when he sent me the script for Civil War and said, I want you to play the president of the United States, I had a good long laugh and then read the script and immediately was just struck with what I love about him. He's a novelist first. He started in his 20s writing novels, one of which was The Beach, which became that DiCaprio movie. And that was his intro into filmmaking. And he transitioned from like screenwriter into full-blown filmmaker. And when I first read this script, the thing I love about him is his novelist's brain. He has this, I always liken him to Kubrick in that he seems to be thinking a few levels above the rest of us. And I think it's so generous and really belies his sensitivity and his sort of love of humanity that he wrote this movie as a sort of cautionary tale for all of us without ever succumbing to the temptation of getting into current politics at all. I mean, we all imagine ourselves to be, you know, pretty clever in one way or another. And if we were, any of us, I think, were to write a movie about contemporary American civil war, we couldn't help. I couldn't help but say, and let me just sneak in a few admonitions for that particular other side, you know, and somehow think that we could like score some points for the good guys. And instead, I read this movie and I just thought, this is so incredible. I immediately get it. I immediately get the medicinal quality of not telling us who are the two sides in the Civil War, who is the president, Republican or Democrat or something else. We don't know any of this stuff. It's in this slightly set in the future fictional America. And so I said, yes, of course, Alex, anything you ever need me to do, I will leap to your side with my googly hard eyes. But I said, the thing to relish about this is we don't need to know any of a lot of this backstory, because as soon as you start to ask him, like, so tell me about the Western forces comprised of California and Texas. And he says, well, yeah, that's part of it. The whole point of it is to just immediately establish that this can't be related to this America that we're living in. This is much more of a representation of the world. You know, here's this advanced government. Here's a rebel force. Florida is also seceding. So it's just representing modern fractionalized governments. You know, fascism is not a new invention. You could substitute a lot of world countries for America in this movie. And so we just pretty quickly in the conversation just started talking about like what my guy would look like and what tools out of my toolbox he wanted for the president, by which I mean, how full of shit do you want this guy to be? You know, yeah. Do you want him to be openly full of shit like some presidents we could imagine? Or do you want him to be doing his best, you know, to be sincere, but still have to be somewhat full of shit like any modern politician is required to be, apparently?
Thinking about this movie and Alex Garland, like when I watched Annihilation, I kept thinking as I watched that movie, there's so much here that I feel like you couldn't even explain to the actors in it. You could like... There's not just visually a lot of interesting things going on, but the feel of the movie, how it lingers on you, is something that I feel like you can't even express within the confines of a script. And I feel like you must have known going into this that there's something about the feel of the movie that's not even going to be, it's not going to be conveyed in script form. Do you like feeling that sense of a filmmaker who's bringing something you probably can't even detect in a script?
Absolutely. I mean, you're totally right, Lewis, that... going in, I mean, because Alex would, if he were here with us, he would say, yeah, I don't even know that it's there until I create, like, I liken it to, when he and his incredible DP, Rob Hardy, when they create the picture, I feel like they're sort of creating a palette full of paint colors, which then Alex takes into the editing booth with his editor, Jake Roberts. And together, then they figure out the painting and the tone. And a great example is when I was sort of getting ready as an actor, as me, working myself up to do these opening speeches for the movie, Alex was watching me. And just in the moment, he said, oh, you know what? Let's roll on this. Let's shoot this. I like this. I like this sort of behind the Wizard of Oz, behind the curtain quality to this mountebank preparing his snake oil speech. And he shot it. And then I was talking with the editor, Jake, at the movie's release. And he said, you know, I love this about Alex so much. We were having a tough time figuring out how to open the movie with a punch. We couldn't come up with like the impact we wanted. And only then did he remember that he had shot this extra stuff of me. And he said, oh shit, hang on. I've got this stuff in Nick. So they dropped that in where you see the president as a guy preparing his song and dance. And suddenly that was the in. It was like, okay, the world's on fire. And here's the America's leader preparing to say everything's cool. That's the in. And I mean, with Annihilation, I agree. I mean, I don't think anyone, including Alex, could have imagined the incredibly anomalous and otherworldly filmic sensations that he created, especially in the Act Three of Annihilation. Once they get to the lighthouse, for those in the know, it's unlike, with the exception of that dinosaur sequence in Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. Those are the only two pieces of filmmaking I've seen in my life that made me feel like the Sagrada de Familia Cathedral in Barcelona, Gaudi's like crazy, trippy, organic masterpiece, where I'm like, okay, you have just touched God. Like, you have just taken me and like pulled open the fabric of Western civilization, and we've looked at God here for a second.
The sublime is what you're talking about. That's exactly the word, sublime, yes.
The thing is, he does it so beautifully with music also and his sound design. But that's the thing. Once you see a few of his pieces and then you get to actually collaborate with him, you go in knowing that he has that skill set and that you're there making the colors with him. And later he's going to figure out what colors he's going to put together.
This is a bit of a sideways question, but related to Alex and this project. People largely know you for comedy, you know, and then you have shifted recently to, you know, Devs and then Last of Us. And now these sort of like sci-fi projects that are very sort of heady, you're thinking about a lot of things involving the world and like the future. And just listening to you talk, you're such a contemplative person with a lot of cultural references, sort of what we do constantly. And I just sort of wonder what interests you culturally that you digest, like books wise or movies wise, like something that you like to read or take in that informs your own cultural worldview or your comedy or even your acting.
It's a funny thing. I just had a big meeting with my agents yesterday to sort of look at the state of the union of my jam. And one of them said something about my choices and where my career is going. And phrases like that, I always shake my head because for better or worse, I come from Chicago theater, a great little theater company called the Defiant Theater. And I've never been sort of a out in front castable talent where, like my wife, the incredible Megan Mullally, she's the kind of kid who grew up who's so bristling with talent that when any kids got together and like, let's put on a show, they're like, oh, we have Megan. Okay, you're the lead. Now let's figure out what all the Nick Offermans are going to do. For me, for many years, I would carry the Megan Mullally on and off stage, and I considered it a privilege to do so. Over the years, I just respond to what writing moves me. And it could be completely stupid comedy. It could be crazy medicinal video game HBO series, like, or it could be like Rob Corddry's web series, Children's Hospital. It could come from any of a number of directions. And Megan is the same. As long as we get the writing and we say, ooh, this is the good shit. And you know that if the writing is good, it's also going to attract other people, like-minded people that we generally get along with and want to work with. I have such a mishmash of influences. In my youth, I grew up in a cultural vacuum in a small town in Illinois. And so it wasn't until college that I met my cool theater school friends, and they started giving me David Lynch, Laurie Anderson, William S. Burroughs, David Byrne, Talking Heads, They Might Be Giants, Neil Gaiman's graphic novels, and on and on. I also have this whole crazy weird side to me that I'm a woodworker. I have a wood shop in Los Angeles. I come from a family that is half farmers. And so I also am fascinated with agrarian agriculture, which basically means living in a way for all of us that is sustainable with Mother Nature's resources, which makes sense when you put it like that. But then if you hold that up against our modern consumerist society, you see the incredible disparities. And so that having an awareness of that, despite being a total jackass in my youth and like a bong champion and a total hedonist, the older I get, the more I try to tie my choices and my work to a sense of responsible values, delivering the medicine to my audience in whatever way I can. That's like, I can make you laugh, I can make you feel things, but also let's think about who's growing our food and at what cost or profit. When you are a theater kid, you just kind of do your best to find yourself cast within the season every year. And that could be comedy, Shakespeare, you know, Harold Pinter, you name it. You just try to have a toolbox and a versatility, which I love. I won like one acting thing in Chicago for this great play called The Kentucky Cycle. And it was like a 7-hour Pulitzer Prize winning drama. And it was playing absolutely horrible villain characters that I loved making the audience love to hate these guys in this play. And so to them, I was like a dramatic actor. Over the years, Parks and Recreation has been the most visible thing, perhaps now with The Last of Us. And so the audience's perception is like, oh, I thought you played tennis, but here you are playing basketball? And I'm like, yes, I'm one of those people who can handle at least two balls.
That should be at the top of your resume. Can handle at least two balls.
Or my epitaph, yeah.
You brought up Megan Mullally now, and I just think, Ira and I have talked about this before, I call these celebrity couples salt and pepper couples. What feels like they were destined to be together. Like out of the constellation of celebrities, certain people just like Peter Sarsgaard and Maggie Gyllenhaal. It's exactly right. I can't explain the math. You know, Mel Brooks and Bancroft, like certain people just should be together. And when I think of you two, I feel like your experience in television qualifies you to be those kinds of couples. In what ways do your tastes differ the most? What do you disagree on the most when it comes to the arts?
That's a great question. And thank you for comparing me to Anne Bancroft and Maggie Gyllenhaal.
would love to see you in like the Elephant Man or what? Yeah. I mean, Anne Bancroft, Agnes of God. Yeah.
I appreciate it. I'd say more like Peter Boyle and Madeleine Kahn. I'm a perfectly healthy fan of myself and think I'm as cute as the day is long. But at the same time, I own a mirror. Like if Donkey and Shrek had a baby, that would be me. and Megan would be Cameron Diaz, I guess. Yeah. So I'm very much the donkey of our household. Megan, among her many talents and attributes, has exquisite, sophisticated taste. I'm super good at carrying luggage and like splitting firewood and running a grill and a meat smoker and like doing the dishes. So where we converge is our love of weird. Like when we first met doing a play, she was getting ready to record her first record with her first band called Supreme Music Program. And she sang me a couple of Tom Waits songs like in my ear backstage at a play. Ruby's Arms was the first one she sang to me. And if you know that song and you imagine Megan Mullally singing it softly into your ear, I defy you not to fucking marry her too. Like it was done. At that moment, I was like, all right, tell me what to do with the rest of my life. You've done it.
Lewis especially loves award shows and sort of hosting in general. And so I'm asking this before him, but, you know, you host Making It with Amy Poehler, and then you've also done the Independent Spirit Awards with Megan. Is that sort of a skill that you have enjoyed tapping into, being an MC?
Absolutely. I hosted the Webby Awards in New York. So it's something that I've done enough of. I've done maybe four or five such things, and a couple of them with Megan. We hosted the awards at Sundance one year, the awards ceremony, and we wrote a song. I'm so proud of it. The bit was, we said that this is so wonderful because around the bedroom, my pet name for Megan's vagina has always been Robert Redford's face. And we wrote this whole song about how I can't wait to like rest my balls on Robert Redford's face. Bob, unfortunately, wasn't there that night. He and I did work together afterwards. And thankfully, nobody, I think, has shared that with him. But we both grew up like admiring and aspiring to like the Carol Burnett Show, I'd say is one of the most powerful comedy resources. For Megan, it's kind of obvious with her skill set. For me, the movies of Mel Brooks and the crossover of like Harvey Korman and Tim Conway and like doing shit with a straight face while you had people wrote in stitches, that was one of the appealing, inciting cultural moments for me. So that is something that we both really love. We have that in our toolboxes and would love to host more such shows. And with Megan, you also have a Broadway star who can, you know, throw in a few musical numbers as well if you've got it in the house.
Speaking of people who often have great deadpan delivery, on Making It, you obviously work with Amy Poehler, worked with Amy Poehler for years on Parks and Recreation. Can you explain the difference between the two dynamics between when you're doing scripted stuff together and unscripted stuff? And is it fun to play with that?
Well, it's such a lucky shotgun seat that I landed in the times that I've gotten to be sort of in that kind of partnership with Amy. I had to audition a lot to end up with the role of Ron Swanson. And the final audition was them taping an improvised scene between the two of us, and I'm a slow-talking, untrained improviser. I do enjoy improvising, but I'm not nimble. I don't have the facility that these UCB performers have from the Upright Citizens Brigade, a theater coincidentally founded by Amy. And so in this audition, I sat there while this comedy dynamo spun up and shot off a bunch of fireworks and sparks and banana peels and hilarity. And then I gave a slight pause and said like one pithy thing. And they said, it's amazing. You're perfectly complimentary. And I was like, oh, great. Just keep your mouth shut and raise an eyebrow or like slowly shut the door or whatever. And so even when you're doing scripted material with Amy, there's this electricity hanging in the air because she can take it or leave it. She can deliver the script sharply, but at any moment, she can also completely win the day with an unexpected improvised moment. Coincidentally, it's like that with Megan as well. Being the lucky supernumerary that gets to stand next to them has that element of just staying as alert as I can in the hopes that I can contribute and be asked to come back again tomorrow.
You said something that really sort of pinpoints what I think about your early career as an actor. Well, you talked about being sort of this deadpan person who lets this comedy happen around you. Really before Parks and Recreation, you were known for just so many sort of smaller roles in so many bigger like Hollywood films. And I'm just wondering, were there any sort of moments on set in any of those films? I'm thinking particularly, you know, like you opposite Sandra Bullock in Miss Congeniality 2, or like you in 21 Jump Street with Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill. Were there any people that you were really sort of had a great time just sort of acting opposite their comedy while you were doing your own thing to sort of react to it?
Sure. I mean, it's a very generous estimation to say that I was known for these things because before Parks and Rec, like, just blew my world open, I was aspiring to a career of dependable character work, the likes of like M. Emmett Walsh or John Carroll Lynch, these thespians who, whenever you see them, you almost never know their names, but they're in everything. And when you see them, you're like, oh, this is going to be good because they have such a high batting average. So that was what I was hoping to aspire to. And I mean, it was crazy. I had this 8-episode arc on the George Lopez sitcom like 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And Sandra Bullock, surprisingly, was an executive producer of that show. She loved George's stand-up and helped create the sitcom. And so from being around that, I ended up being cast as one of the two main bad guy brothers in Miss Congeniality 2, Armed and Fabulous. The 21 Jump Street thing, that came after Parks and Rec had begun. And so I was able to bring more personality to that. And it's interesting. Like, once you break through the ceiling of becoming a known entity, then you're being cast. And so Lord and Miller put me in those movies because of what I brought with me from Parks and Rec. So when Channing and Jonah sit down across from me, the audience has some idea of what this deadpan police captain is about. I did an episode of Will and Grace early on with Megan. Getting to work with, you know, champions like Sandra or Megan usually was just an incredible learning experience. And if I tried to insert a little more personality, I'm pretty sure they would have told me to take it down a notch. In fact, I probably did try to be like, hey, guys, I've also got some pizzazz to offer to the world of showbiz. And they're like, okay, plumber with four lines, just fucking knock on the door and let the star of the show slap you and then get the fuck out. You know, my career has been a very slowly rolling snowball. Like, I got my SAG card when I was 23. I got Ron Swanson when I was 38. I'm now 53. And so in the early aughts, things were starting to go a little better, a little better. You know, I got cast in this movie called The Men Who Stare at Goats, which is a great little comedy based off a wonderful John Ronson book. And I got an audition for this movie, and all we knew is that George Clooney was producing it. And he and I had had a nice rapport on an episode, a live episode of ER that I had done in like 98. And Megan, the audition was for a one line role. And I was like, I really feel like I should draw a line here and stop going in for one liners. Like, you know, if I elevate myself, then maybe they'll see me in that way. And Megan was like, well, George really liked you on the blah, blah, blah. And I always listened to her advice. So I went into this audition. It was a long casting hallway of all these other jerks that I have known for 12 years, all the other one-liners and like guys that I would see at beer commercials or whatever. And the bit was, it was a scene about, it's a true story about psychic soldiers. Our armed forces were legitimately in the 80s trying to develop a platoon of psychic soldiers because they heard that Russia had some psychic soldiers. This really happened. It's a great book by John Ronson. So the scene was for this supporting private to come in at like the audition of the psychic soldiers and look at a box on a table, and he's supposed to say what's in the box. And so it's one line, and I forget what the line was. You know, it was like, is it red or something? So my bit was, I wore a pair of glasses to the audition. And she's like, okay, go ahead. We're taping, you know. Okay, whenever you're ready. And so I sort of squint looking at the box. And then I take my glasses off and like slightly cross my eyes. And then I say the line as though I have to take my glasses off to get the proper focus to use my psychic powers. It's a very small piece of, you know, a drop of hot sauce. But like, that was my choice. I was like, here's what I'm going to do. And the casting director said, let's go again, but can you not do the thing with your glasses? And I was like, no. I'm incredibly nice and a people pleaser. So I said, you know what? No, thank you. Like, I don't want to give you the option of me with it. Like, what the fuck are we doing here? Like, it's one line. It was such a little crazy little thing. And I was like, whatever, this was such a waste. And I left. 3 months later, we were on vacation in Calistoga, Northern California. And I get a call from my agent. You got the job. They need you in Puerto Rico tomorrow night. And I'm like, okay, crazy. And this is pre Parks and Rec. So whatever the deal was, it was like, you know, 5 weeks of work. It was a wonderful little windfall. I fly to Puerto Rico. I mean, it's kind of a whirlwind. I land, they pick me up. I don't know whatever happened, if somebody dropped out, but everything was incredibly last minute. So I went from the airport straight to the hair and makeup trailer on set. They stick some sideburns on me. They take me into the set, and my scene is it's me, Jeff Bridges, Clooney, and Kevin Spacey. It's the four of us. And I'm this unknown jerk. And I literally do the exact bit, the glasses and like, that's the scene that we started with. And so there are things like that that are so incredibly educational, where I got to be, and I had a few more scenes with all of these guys. We shot a bunch of it also in Roswell, New Mexico. And so even though I wasn't yet being offered the opportunity to like bring my full jazz, I was still getting to play fourth trumpet in this particular swing band and watch Louis Armstrong sitting first chair and be like, okay, I see. Watching Jeff Bridges do a speech over and over again and just be like, okay, someday if I ever get to do that speech, I will take these lessons with me. So it's, you know, sorry, that's an incredibly long-winded answer, but until it's an interesting thing that I hadn't really thought about until this question, that until you sort of are welcomed by the world to bring your particular hot sauce, they're like, no, you are one of the beans in this burrito. So please don't, we don't need your flavor just yet.
You've spun a number of wonderful metaphors. I just want to say I'm cherishing them all.
Well, it's usually going to be food or baseball or woodworking, but that makes it. So then once you get something like Parks and Rec and the world says, holy shit, what is in this sauce? We like it. You're like, oh, thank goodness. I've been fermenting this, my gravy for all these years. And finally you want it on your potatoes.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It's been fabulous interviewing you. And I must say before you go that in that Last of Us episode, you are now the world's leading, as far as I'm concerned, Linda Ronstadt propagandist. Our tribe has needed you for years and years. And finally, the world is out there being like, long, long time. What is this? Maybe I'll check out the rest of her catalog. Oh, thank God.
Can you believe? I'm so grateful. Thank you. For so many things, in one episode of a new HBO series, Craig Mazin, with the foundational world of Neil Druckmann, who created the game and co-created the show with Craig. I am just the luckiest shoveler to have been chosen as the vessel for their incredible genius and that of Linda Ronstadt and everybody else. This has been really edifying, and I've really appreciated your intelligent questions. In one third of the time that it takes most podcasts to get half that information.
Mathematically, we get the most out of it. Yes, we love to bring that quality to this.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Just when we were getting a break from the Keep It Obituaries, which is going to be our spinoff podcast at this point, O.J. Simpson died last Thursday.
Talk about a legacy.
Yeah. You know, I haven't worn gloves the same since that trial.
And they're so fetching on you, too. So I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. And my gloves always fit, unfortunately. So I've never quit it.
You've learned nothing. Yeah. Do you know what I learned on Twitter the other day from screenwriter Zach Stentz, who's one of my favorite people to follow? He said, the most random bit of trivia that I remember from the O.J. Simpson case is that one of his biggest fights with Nicole Brown began when she told him he shouldn't do any more Naked Gun movies because they were hurting his chances of winning an Oscar in the future. Was she killed because she spilled? He was not going to get an Oscar at that rate.
That is a segment in a game show, for sure. Was she killed because she spilled?
I'm sorry to do that to everybody. It's a horrible case. It's a horrible period in American history. The one thing I will say about the O.J. Simpson case before we talk about other tabloid cases that we remember and actually, I don't know, cherish, it was endless. Like, you could turn on the TV at any time and half of your favorite shows could be interrupted because some development in the O.J. trial occurred. That was the beginning of you can't escape a story. I'm trying to think of other things that have been like that. Like the Amy Fisher story before that was shockingly huge, shockingly huge enough that Madonna, while being a musical guest on SNL, made reference to it. First of all, mocking Sinead O'Connor holding up a picture of the Pope, but she held up a picture of Joey Badafuoco. Imagine feeling obligated to do that. You know, like Gerard Carmichael, the week he hosted SNL, he had to say something about the Chris Rock slap. It was that level. But like the Oscars are something we all watch and enjoy. That is just a weird crime in the blotter. It's so strange.
Well, the year prior also was the Loretta Bobbitt story.
Yes.
And that also like sort of dominated the news cycle. Roy Wood Jr. sort of tweeted about this, that there's an amazing set from Martin Lawrence about the Loretta Bobbitt sort of scandal, but it's on a CD, a stand-up CD. So it wasn't filmed. So, you know, that's why it hasn't sort of recirculated within the pop culture sphere. But, you know, people were talking about that story nonstop as well.
In thinking about what the greatest tabloid story of all time is, of course, Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan come to mind just because of the sheer lunacy of, could really Tonya Harding and like her, I was going to say goons, but I'll say galoonies, conspire to like destroy another athlete's career in order just to secure this weird win? But even so, like there is like a violent act there. It's just not comfortable to think about. I didn't love Itanya's spin on it. Like there's no new angle on this. I believe she was part of the violent act, Tonya Harding. Anyway, I'm sorry to say that when the Gwyneth Paltrow ski trial happened, I did not cherish it for what it was, which is the loveliest tabloid story of all time. You know, something weird happened on a vacation. Nobody was terribly injured. He claims he was injured, but like that was dubious or whatever. And then you got three killer personality moments out of Gwyneth. And I'm not saying she's not dubious in other ways, but literally saying be well to somebody as she exits a courtroom. I mean, you can hear in that statement the sweater she is wearing. You can you feel the Gwyneth skincare routine. Everything about her personality came out in that trial. And I think, unfortunately, made me even a bigger fan. And as you know, all I do on this podcast is beg for her to come back to movies. Sorry, movies I want to see.
Yeah, the sweaters, the fashion. There is something, too, about how the celebrification of crime has sort of contributed to this. I mean, I just saw Chicago again recently because my friend Ariana Maddox from Vanderpump Rules was in it. She was fantastic, by the way. I saw the final performance, and you could still see that she had really gotten very comfortable with that role in becoming Roxy Hart. But the whole Roxy Hart, Velma Kelly of it, you know, every time a celebrity is on trial for anything, particularly women, it's sort of a runway as they're going to the courthouse.
Yeah.
You know, there's a fashion, there's the photographers. It just becomes a bit of a bonanza. So it was nice that with Gwyneth, there wasn't really anything sort of like someone was murdered or anything else. It was, this is just silly.
And she also literally said, well, I lost a few hours of skiing that day. I mean, that's the victim. You know what I mean? You know, Hilaria Baldwin is sort of a similar situation where it's just victimless and it's not literally a trial, of course, but it's literally wondering, this woman just making up a whole personality and origin story, even though she's just somebody who seemingly teaches yoga and has 777 kids.
Victimless? Listen, they didn't see her on that set, but I know they both reached for the gun.
Okay. that doesn't sound right. I'm the one with a journalism degree here, not you.
I want to go back to OJ for a second because one of the funniest ways to find out that a celebrity has died is when someone tweets about their death. And I discovered that I was flying to Coachella, and when I landed at LAX, I opened my phone, and there are texts in the group chat after someone had sent in Caitlyn Jenner's tweet said, "Good riddance."
The voice of reason, as always.
And their responses to Caitlyn Jenner were fantastic. Many people reminding her that she has the same body count as OJ.
Come on.
Many people reminding her, we'd like to see you there too.
Good Lord. Oh my God. The internet is horrid. Horrid.
It's just, you can't also be a horrible person and then publicly celebrate the death of a horrible person without knowing that people will also be like, wait a second, bitch.
Right. They are definitely both in the pantheon of utterly famous and no fans. So that's exciting that there's at least two in that group. And they hate each other, I guess.
Yeah. You know, former athletes turn demons.
Yeah. Turn demons.
Are the Naked Gun movies a worse tarnish on your acting career than that Village People movie that Caitlin was in?
Wow. These should be compared. I would love to see someone get a PhD because of this dissertation. Let me see. Can't Stop the Music is what Ira is talking about. It is a movie starring the Village People. It is directed by Nancy Walker, who was known at the time for playing Valerie Harper's mother on the show Rhoda. Steve Guttenberg is also in this movie. And it is basically a roller skating fiasco of a disco movie. It came out along the time of movies like Thank God It's Friday or Fame or movies like that. And it is so insanely bad. It's just, again, the Village People didn't really have speaking voices before this, and we decided they were going to be people we knew and loved during this movie, and frankly we were wrong. And I'm just going to say there maybe were a lot of drugs going on in the late 70s, so maybe that informed this decision.
Speaking of just sort of athletes turning to crime, you're bringing up the Tonya Harding thing. The thing that's shocking about the Tonya Harding story to me is actually that this hasn't happened more often.
Right. Yes. That people would sort of conspire to work against somebody else who seems unstoppable.
Yeah. Particularly in the world of sports.
Right.
There's obviously that story about the mother of the cheerleader who hired that hitman that time. It's referenced in Bring It On as well. But, you know, it seems like something that would sort of inspire people to, you know, try to take out their rivals.
And also, I will say about the Tonya Harding thing, if we didn't have that story, we wouldn't have Nancy Kerrigan in that Disney parade mouthing under her breath, this is so stupid, or this is so boring, or this is so corny, again and again. And I love seeing a
crowned American princess, just hate what is happening around her. And then she hosted SNL and she made the joke. I wasn't saying it's so corny. I was saying it's so horny, which is a hilarious and strange joke. I can't believe she said it.
I love the 90s.
Yeah. We need another round of that on VH1. Again, the kids don't know shit. So you and I think, need to get into a booth in Van Nuys, put a camera in front of us, and just ask me about things like, you know, Pokemon and Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and let us go off.
Well, I think that's all we need to say about O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
You know?
God love the girl.
The juice. I'm still drinking it.
I have nothing to say to that. Sorry. I'm exasperated with what you just said.
Someone left the juice out in the rain. Okay.
Oh. Would love to have seen a disco moment from him.
All right. When we are back, it is time for Keep It. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis?
Yes?
What do you say Keep It to this week?
Well, you know, I'm a fan of really good interviews and people who can't help but give good interviews. We've had Chloe Sevigny had a wonderful run recently. You know, Fran Lebowitz usually is good for a quote or two. Unfortunately, Azealia Banks has opinions every once in a while that will make me laugh before, you know, a shiver runs down my spine, as it should. But the queen of this once upon a time was Courtney Love, who seemingly you could not get off the phone with Spin Magazine once upon a time. You would turn around, you would try to leave the room, and oh my, a scare quote from Blender Magazine from Courtney Love talking about how Alanis Morissette is artificial at every level would greet you. Anyway, she's finally back in a really brief interview with The Guardian, I believe, and she was asked her opinion on several different artists. She said something somewhat snotty about Taylor Swift, saying that her music isn't important, but she's probably the Madonna of right now in terms of the scale of who she is. She talked about how she hasn't liked Lana Del Rey since she released a cover of Take Me Home Country Roads by John Denver. Okay, that's really funny. That is so funny that she would just turn on an artist after that, after one bad decision. And she also said regarding PJ Harvey, who I'm wearing a shirt of today, she said, just the first four albums, then I'm done. Like, she is a fan. I miss the bitchiness of quotes that you could be like, yeah, I'm kind of a fan of them. Not all the time, you know, and just we love that. You know, I think it's because once upon a time you didn't have Twitter where these quotes would come back to haunt you again and again and again. They would just live in a blurb in a magazine. And so they kind of, I think people kept them in perspective. It's just something someone said one time that would become outdated after a while, or, you know, we would move on from that issue of that magazine and maybe they would change or maybe they wouldn't. My Keep It is to people online who are saying, this woman wants attention. If you don't understand how Courtney Love works, you pick up the phone with her, you say, hello, and she immediately just starts talking and giving every opinion she's ever had and telling you things about Kurt Cobain you didn't even want to know. I'm telling you, they didn't even ask her. She just went on about it. So I'm saying, like, even though during her famous interjection when she interrupted Madonna being interviewed at the 1995 VMAs, threw a compact at her from the red carpet, ran up to the interview and sat with her during this uncomfortable tete-a-tete with Kurt Loder and Madonna, where Madonna was actually sliced and diced her with some wit. Even though Madonna said in that moment, Courtney Love is in dire need of attention right now, I truly think what Courtney's about is not attention. I think she is just so unfazed with how horrible fame is and thinks to herself, I can just be honest because who cares? Like, she's done not being impressive to people. She's had some of the worst, meanest insults ever hurled at a celebrity, I think. Like, the way people treated her in the wake of her husband's death is just bone-chilling to this day, I think. And I'm not saying I admire every opinion she has or agree with every opinion she has. I loved the interview.
I mean, I am such a fan of that Courtney Love and Madonna moment.
Oh, it's so good. Madonna looks amazing, by the way.
Yeah, it's something we need more of. We really don't have instances where an insane celebrity could just sort of harass another one.
Well, it's crazy. It seems it's a very unlikely moment as it happens, because as Courtney Love throws her compact at Madonna, who feels it, Madonna turns around, makes the comment to Kurt Loder saying she's in dire need of attention right now. And Kurt has the wherewithal to be like, bring her up. which is a very unusual move. Normally, they would just move right along, I think. So it's a strange and unpredictable moment. But to be honest, right now...
They certainly would now. A publicist would not allow... So, like, if someone did that to Taylor Swift...
Hell no.
Tree Payne would be like, they're not coming up here.
You know what's interesting, though? In that instance, I feel like Taylor Swift could handle herself pretty well. I think we'd be exposed to, like, the darker, sardonic humor she may have in that moment. I'm not saying I need this to happen. Taylor Swift is somebody who I think is rightfully protected. I think people are creepy about her. So, but I think she would do well.
Who would throw a compact at Taylor?
Oh, I love the idea, though. Oh, my God. Who do I think would do it? Who's, like, rowdy? It's like somebody with an Azealia Banks spirit, but it's not Azealia Banks.
Mm-hmm. Doja?
Chapel Roan?
Maybe Chapel. Because Doja just likes sort of like being bothered herself.
Yeah.
So I don't see her bothering anybody else.
All I'm saying is we saw that video last week of Chapel Roan watching JoJo Siwa's music video and she was openly shady. So I'm going to take that iota of a moment and apply it here.
By the way, JoJo Siwa sort of packed a Miami Beach Pride concert this past weekend. So maybe people are tuning into her rebrand, at least out of morbid curiosity.
Right. Well, again, she's dressed like a Power Rangers villain, which people of a certain age have an affinity for, you know. Siwa Repulsa, as it were.
As long as someone's going to fight the Putty Patrol.
Right.
It's got to be her.
I love how they said the putties after the Power Rangers all the time, and they were not good one time. Maybe we need another committee.
Even when they updated the Putty Patrol, they somehow made them easier to beat. Do you remember they first just used to be these gray blobs in suits who were fighting the Power Rangers? And then once Lord Zedd became one of the main villains in Power Rangers, the putties got these sort of like circle symbols on their chest that you basically just had to hit to kill them.
Which don't show your death symbols if you're going to get into a fight. Cover those up. Put on a bomber jacket. Anything. Ira, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it today is twofold.
Oh.
One, I'm going to talk about Panera Bread.
Please do.
I love Panera Bread, okay? I have found my people in New York City, and these are people who love Panera.
Okay.
It is perfect fast casual food because, you know, there's no drive-thrus. There's just you go in, you order your food, you sit down. There's community there, you know?
You enter a Panera and your life immediately slows down. You, like, simmer to the temperature and speed of a Panera.
Plus, in Milwaukee, in high school, when I used to work at Barnes & Noble at Mayfair Mall, my Panera card got a workout because that's where I had lunch every day.
Once upon a time, Panera was not getting my favorite food. When I went to the University of Iowa, my girlfriend, Lauren Nybert, and I would scam our way to Coralville, which was too far, and we didn't have a car because we wanted to go to Panera so bad. This was my life. Yes.
Yeah. I think I sort of transitioned to Panera from my high school obsession was Noodle & Company, in which I used to go to Evanston all the time to get when I was at Loyola Chicago because we did not have one in Chicago proper. But as soon as you got to the suburbs.
The lives of deprivation we left. Okay. Yes. So what's up with Panera?
But Panera, one, someone tweeted that Panera isn't tasty. It's the ultimate white people food. And all the people that I know that love Panera are black, first of all, okay? A white person tweeted this, too, and I'm sick of white-on-white crime as a joke, okay? I'm going to say, this is white people like this. If you're white tweeting this, enough of that.
Yeah.
Okay?
It reminds me of, do you remember Stuff White People Like, that whole phenomenon once upon a time? And it was like white people joking with each other. Oh, yeah, we do love the idea of soccer, but none of us really know about soccer. It got a little smug in like 10 minutes. Yeah.
White people love tried to look like they're above being white.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And you can't transcend it. Trust me, I've tried.
And you're not. You are in that white skin.
Yar.
I was trying to like what happened to Baby Jane.
Yes, oh, I know. Oh, I know. Yes, yes. Starring maybe the whitest performance.
I mean, Chapel Roan's inspiration.
Yes, there it is. Nope. Definitely, yes.
The white face in that movie is definitely her inspiration. But the other thing I would like to say about Panera Bread is that they have recently started taking items from their menu.
Oh, no.
And I hate when a chain that you have been going to for decades all of a sudden decides, you know what? What if we just phased out several menu items? It happens all the fucking time.
It's sad. Because the whole point is it's a constancy. You know what I mean? Like, some things are never changing. You know, Vanna White is always on Wheel of Fortune. Legally, she cannot leave. I need her literally embalmed at the board. Okay.
It's the same thing as, you know, like McDonald's, where they would take some things away. You know, bring back those wraps.
Yeah. Panera, all the food is so good too. For any of it to go away, I need a half sandwich, I need a half soup. And also for a chain, the bread is so good.
The bread is really fucking good. Is the bread maybe a bit too expensive? Am I paying $25 for half of a sandwich and a soup? Maybe.
Yeah, well, luxury is a great time. Sorry. It makes it more fun to me.
Yeah, but I'll never quit Panera because it is 10 minutes away on DoorDash my apartment. And there is really just something underestimated about when you get home late from somewhere and you know this food can arrive in 10 minutes. If it's not arriving in 10 to 20 minutes, I'm actually not going to eat.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So you're saying it's your best friend. Yeah.
Yeah. Panera's my best friend. So.
No, I haven't thought about Panera in a long time. Basically, if I were in high school and I had the guts to ask a girl out on a date, we would probably end up at a Panera.
Of course you haven't been thinking about Panera because it's not food for white people.
Yeah, I feel guilty now.
Panera's a sister, okay? Pronounced Panera, actually.
You in the Panera tent at Coachella, I'm sure.
All right. This has been our episode. I'll be back in New York next week like a normal person. Hopefully all of the dust will be out of my sinuses.
But I do like a little gravel. Give me a little Kathleen Turner every week. Ain't nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Thank you to Nick Offerman for joining us. Fantastic guest.
And we will see you next week.
Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are Chris Lord and CJ Siege Polkinghorne. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James. Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Shang, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroot, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.